Hey, hey, hey. Wow, that's good. That's good. That feels really good to get in here and to sit down and have that music, and it just sets me off, all right? And I'm going to be real quick today because we have a hell of a show for you. It's three really packed segments, all right? Back on the back end, we're going to be talking with Brant Olson, the executive director of climatetruth.org, and it's one of the groups that helped organize the Stand Up for Science rally in San Francisco and is assisting the March for Science. And we'll be talking about the March for Science on April 22nd in Washington, D.C., and with satellite marches in over 430 other cities. Before that, we will be joined by Josh Willis, oceanographer and climatologist and principal investigator of Oceans Melting Greenland. All right, this is not a segment to miss, all right, or to snooze through, because if you remember, I've had him on a couple of other times, and he's always got something very interesting and compelling to say. Plus, he punches me in the nose if nobody is listening, okay? So please, please stay tuned on that one, all right? But opening the show up, I'm very pleased to be bringing you an interview I did just a little while ago with Robert Shankin. Robert is the person who wrote the play Building the Wall, and he wrote it in 7 days last fall as the election loomed. He's talking about why he wrote it, the effort to have it performed as widely as possible. And Robert is a Pulitzer Prize and Tony Award-winning playwright and an Academy Award-nominated screenwriter. And I'm not going to say much more because I want you to actually hear the interview, and then we'll be back after that. So here's my interview with Robert Shankin. Robert, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Yeah. Your play just is blowing a lot of minds. It's an extremely, extremely important piece out in the world today. And I want to talk to you about some of the things that really hit me about it. So let's jump into it. Let's start by talking about the birth of the play. You said that you wrote it in a white hot fury and finished in a week. What is it that compelled you to do this?
Well, this was in late October as one of the more dispiriting presidential campaigns lurched to a close. I was extremely angry and anxious at what I was hearing and how it was being treated in the press. I thought that the then Republican presidential candidate's rhetoric was quite deliberately incendiary and had crossed a serious line. And I kept hearing fairly respected commentators, press, as well as politicians, trying to reassure us that he didn't mean it, or that it was just words, or that they would protect us. And I didn't believe that. I thought that regardless of how the election turned out, and I will be honest, I expected a different result, but I thought, however the election turned out, that we had already crossed a serious line politically and culturally, and I needed to respond to that as an artist. And so I sat down and I wrote this play in a week. That is a bit faster than my normal process, which can take several months or even several years. But I had such a strong impulse here and such a sense of urgency about the situation. I felt then, and even more today, that we are in the middle of an unfolding political crisis, the magnitude of which I certainly have never seen in my lifetime, and I doubt the Republic has in 100 years. Certainly not in terms of such an internal threat.
Mm-hmm. Let's go a little further with this because, you know, it's interesting when you're talking about what drove you to write it. And actually, when you see it, well, the play is situated in the aftermath of the Trump regime to a certain extent, and it has a certain progression built on the most horrendous and terrible things that were done. You've argued, though, that this is not some kind of wild-ass science fiction here, that in many ways it's the logical conclusion of where things are headed. And I think your point about just seeing the way it's rolling out, there is a logic to the way it's falling out. And let's talk about that in relation to you doing this play.
Oh, absolutely. The play is set in the near future, fall of 2019, and you could call it speculative fiction. But I would argue that the alternate reality that I've envisioned here is one that could very easily be brought into being, and that what we are seeing right now in the early months of this new political regime, while startling and infuriating and scary, is not new. This is a page out of a very old handbook, the Authoritarian Handbook. The process here is pretty straightforward. You make the populace feel afraid and isolated and anxious. You position yourself as the strong leader who is the only person capable of rescuing them. There are appeals to nativism and racism, scapegoating of minorities, racial, religious, and a consolidation of power and the diminution of personal liberties. When the President of the United States describes the free press, the American press, as an enemy of the people, a phrase so toxic that Nikita Khrushchev could not bring himself to use it at the height of the communist power in the 60s, we have already gone a long ways down a dark road. And people need to be very conscious of what's happening.
Mm-hmm. It's heavy to me, too, because the way you present this, it's all very compelling and challenging, your approach in terms of the content of the thing. And you have these two characters. And frankly, the interaction between the two, there's sort of an edge to it. But then there's also a way that they're really exploring where each other is coming from to a certain extent. There's a lot going on in terms of the confrontation and interaction between those two characters themselves that are arguing out arguments that are taking place in the society and that are very, very organically tied up with what you just said about this being this just unfathomable crime against humanity.
Well, thank you. That's certainly what I intend to do here. The play's not intended to be a polemic. I'm actually trying to get at some complicated ideas that we are struggling with, some complicated issues that are not black and white. There's a reason why people who would not normally have voted for our current president did during this election. And this has to do with very real economic and societal failures. And that creates the conditions in which this kind of authoritarian figure can arise. It's very important to understand that, not to excuse, but to understand so that we can solve the underlying problem and hopefully change the circumstances under which we're currently struggling. So, yes, with these two characters who are different in many ways. He's a blue-collar managerial type who ran a private prison, and he's white male. The other character, Gloria, is an African-American female who's a professor of history. And they come together in this one moment. Rick has been convicted of some unspecified but obviously pretty serious crime and is awaiting sentencing. And interestingly, Gloria is the only person that he, or the first person, that he is allowed to interview him. And so they're both here in this cell trying to understand history, trying to understand what happened. And to some degree, Rick is honestly struggling as much as Gloria is to understand what he's done and what the consequences are. And these people, like all people, come into this room with certain set of expectations and stereotypes about the other person and the other person's politics. And these are confounded and surprised over again. And both people are forced to recognize more than once how limited their understanding is, how narrow their perspective is, and how complicated people are. That's quite intentional. The play is intended to appeal to a very broad audience and to play regardless of your politics or whether you're urban or rural or blue state or red state, because it speaks to a very fundamental human condition. The challenge here, as the challenge always is, between the conscience of the individual and the power of the state. This is a struggle that's central to the dynamic tension of democracy. Aeschylus was exploring this 2,000 years ago. It's still true today. We like to think of our democracies as vibrant and healthy and strong, and yet we're seeing very clearly, and not just in the United States, but in Europe as well, how fragile they are, really, how easily it is to wobble, to spin off course, and how important, how even more important it is then for citizens to exercise their moral principle, their moral choice, and not cede that authority to the authorities.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with playwright and screenwriter Robert Chaykin, and we're talking about his new play, Building the Wall. I want to follow up on that a little bit, too, because one of the things that struck me, and I've heard a number of people wrestling with the content of the play, and then some people will start to try to like get into and understand, in quotes, understand why Rick does what he does, mm-hmm. this heinous stuff that he does. And to me, what came across more in your play was this point about basically there's no understanding in terms of there's no forgiveness when somebody actually does this. And I keep thinking about Nasty Girl, that film Nasty Girl, where she went back to Germany and she went to the village where her grandparents lived or something. And she starts talking to all these people, and all these people had done the most horrendous things, turning in their neighbors and everybody to the Gestapo and people being slaughtered and tortured. And no one wanted to talk about it and pretended it was all in the past, or maybe it was necessary for us to do. But I thought that what you do with this, the way you work out this struggle here, is that people are challenged not to forgive, even if you're saying, okay, you want people to understand how this happens. It's not a question of forgiving somebody like that, because there actually were crimes against humanity that are being dealt with here. That's very heavy. I'd like to talk with you about that. And linked to that is that the point that you've quoted a couple of times, where you say that old quote about the only thing necessary for the triumph of evil is that good men do nothing.
Well, it's very true. I was just reading an interesting article the other day in the newspaper, a review of a book talking about the Gestapo, and how actually the number of members of the Gestapo, the Nazi Germany police force, are astonishingly small given the size of the population, and that they managed to intimidate and control something like 3,800 citizens for every single Gestapo agent. Well, obviously, it's not that that single agent is in contact with every one of those 3,800 people and every moment of the day. So what's keeping them in line? And what's obviously keeping them in line and keeping them intimidated and keeping them subservient is their own concession to the state. And that's a critical notion, that they gave their power away. They ceded their power to the authorities. And even if they were not explicitly active in the criminal activities that were perpetuated by their regime, they were implicitly involved because they didn't say no, because they didn't stand up, they didn't take a stand. And that's a very, very important thing to keep in mind. We actually, as citizens, have more power than we think, and certainly more power than the authorities would like us to believe. In order, in a democracy, for a political ideology to be translated into social policy and practical action, it requires the buy-in of enormous numbers of people. And if that buy-in doesn't happen, then the policy doesn't happen. And that means that lots and lots of individuals acting as individuals and then as groups have taken a stance against it. We just saw this recently in the voting down of the repeal and replace of Obamacare in the House. They tried to force a crazy quilt Frankenstein of a bill, which would have had horrendous consequences. And the pushback was so intense from ordinary citizens who just got in their faces that they backed down. They couldn't even hold the vote because it would have been so embarrassing. That's the power of an informed, aroused citizenship. And that's the important thing in a democracy.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with playwright and screenwriter Robert Chaykin, and we're talking about his new play, Building the Wall. Let me ask you this, Robert, because it's one of the things that gets to me is that when you're talking about this, a friend actually told me, we were talking about the play and we were talking about, well, sometimes there's people arguing that, well, Rick's circumstances led him to do this. And he was really anguished and he was really struggling around it. And I kept arguing with people, but he did it. You know, people get worried about this and they think about, like, well, he isn't a monster, so maybe that means he couldn't do monstrous things. And I kept thinking, well, no, people have done many monstrous things, including if you think back to the times of the lynchings in this country, where many, many white people came together and we're not getting our jobs. We're being screwed over by these black people are taking all the stuff and they're out there lynching people. You know, it's people, other people are trying to understand why they did it. Well, there actually are times that when people basically, they decide that they are going to do things that are, in fact, crimes against humanity. Even if they don't think that they are, they can see what's actually doing. If you're going out and you're lynching somebody or you're helping someone do whatever, you're helping them get into the gas chambers, that's a problem.
Right. Well, we are all of us the hero of our own play. We rarely think or admit that we might be wrong or that our motives might be less than pure. It requires a very, very strong constitution and conscience to be able to examine one's motives and one's action in an objective manner. But it's critical that we attempt that. Rick's slow progression here to Golgotha is full of half steps and quarter steps that in and of themselves make sense, sort of, don't seem necessarily bad in the moment, but cumulatively, we can see that he's going down a certain kind of path, and the consequences of which are dire, and as you suggest, ultimately unforgivable. The only way one avoids that, and this is what the play's ultimate argument is, the only way one avoids that is by staying very conscious in your life. It's critical to stay awake, to be aware of what's happening. It's so easy, and the human tendency to avoid unpleasantness or deny unpleasantness is almost overwhelming. It's part of how we're hardwired, particularly a threat that doesn't appear immediate. You know, it's fascinating. I don't know if you saw this recent article in the New York Times about American citizens and their perceptions of climate change. There's actually now a fairly sizable majority, 70%+, who agree with the statement that climate change is happening and it's man-made. But what's fascinating is only 20% of those same people feel that it's having any impact on them. And therein lies the dichotomy and the terrible, terrible problem that we're facing, which is we're not feeling the consequences of our actions nearly acutely enough. And as a consequence, we're not able or willing or ready to change our actions, even though we are setting in motion terrible forces, which once unleashed may never be able to be recaptured. But that's the human condition, and it requires a real effort to surmount that, to be awake, to be aware, and to make our choices consciously.
Let me ask you this. In this play, and when you write about the play, you go into talking about, I don't know if I'll pronounce her name right, Getsemane?
Yes, I think that's how it's pronounced.
Okay. And you go
not
into
sure.
And her book. Into that
yes.
darkness and what you learned from it. And I wanted to talk to you about that because it seems that what I was able to gather from what I saw you say about it, it has a lot to do with this point we're just talking about, related to the point that you make about how it's not so much what authorities do, but how people respond. Tell us about Getsemane's book and the impact it had on you and how it's related to that point.
Yes, this is a kind of a classic now in Holocaust literature. And I just stumbled across it. And I couldn't even tell you how. It is an investigation into the life and times of this one individual who, for a brief moment, became extremely powerful in the Nazi death machinery. And she spends almost 60 hours interviewing him, but she also interviews his wife and family members and colleagues and people who survived him. And it's a real attempt to come to sort of grips with how did you wind up doing these kinds of things. And it was very, very provocative and very illuminating. For me personally, my grandfather, who was a Dutch Jew who immigrated in the 1920s, not just out of economic necessity, but also because I think he saw the coming cloud of fascism. And he lost 16 family members in the Holocaust. And the loss was so painful that he actually never spoke of it to me. I did not know this part of my family history until I discovered it by accident in my 30s. That's how painful and profound the loss was, the wound was. And I know that reading that book, which I did almost a year ago, certainly had an influence in me and certainly found some expression in the play that I've written.
Mm-hmm. Now, my final question. You've said that you wanted to get this play out as widely as possible, which you really put a great effort into doing, and I hope it spreads all over the country. And in fact, you've even described this time now as similar to the last days of the Weimar Republic in Germany, which I was really glad to see somebody's finally, yes, it is similar to the last days of the Weimar Republic. And for people that don't know, that regime, the Weimar regime, was the one that was defeated by Hitler in Germany, opening the door for Hitler to come into power in Germany. But to me, that lends this whole thing a proper sense of urgency in this. And I'd like you to talk about what you see, because when you talk about this as the last days of the Weimar Republic, and you see you pose that before people who are maybe doubting that or half-stepping around all this, myself, I think that lends it exactly the right amount of urgency. Let's talk about that.
I feel that the situation right now is extremely urgent. I feel that the political crisis, and I'm using my words very, very carefully here, the political crisis that we're experiencing is not a conflict between Republicans and Democrats. It's not even a conflict between conservatives and liberals. What we're experiencing is a concerted and very conscious attack on fundamental American values, basic values, the heart of our democracy. I refer, of course, to things like the separation of powers, an independent judiciary, freedom of press, free speech. This is what's under attack. To me, if I was a conservative, I would be just as concerned about that as a liberal. This is what makes our democracy and our republic what it is. And I think what is really worrisome is that we're experiencing this from the executive branch, but those individuals, those leaders, political leaders in the legislative branch, are either silent or essentially lining up in support of what's happening. And that's really scary and appalling. Fortunately, we're seeing a lot of pushback in the judicial branch, and that's reassuring. But there are far too many representatives, both in the House and the Congress and then in state legislators, who have just temporarily shelved their conscience in order to take advantage of this once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to wield elite power. And that's very, very worrisome. And between now and the midterm elections, this is when any new administration is at its powers are at its strongest. So it will really require all of us, I think, to A, be very conscious, B, to make the choices we make, small and great choices, with great moral clarity, and to not cede our moral authority to the establishment.
All right, Robert Shankin, thank you very much on this, man. I really enjoyed talking
to you. Great to talk to you. Appreciate
sure.
it.
Yeah,
thank you.
All right, bye now.
Bye-bye.
All right, we've just been talking with playwright Robert Shankin about his new play, Building the Wall. And for more information on the Rolling World premiere in 6 different cities, check out the National New Play Network, and that's at nnpn.org. And believe me, Robert has said, you just come to him with an idea that where you want to put it up, you want to put it in your basement, you want to put it out in the town square, go ahead and do it, all right? This is a play that he really wants to get out there. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back with the notorious Josh Willis, and you'll find out a lot more about him in case you weren't listening a little while ago when he was on. So stay tuned. Welcome back. That's Breeding Resistance, a.k.a. Paper Tiger Blues from Ted Sirota's Rebel Souls, all right? And you remember Ted, we had him on the show talking about the new group that he formed, political group, bringing in a lot of musicians, a lot of artists called Degenerate Artists, okay? And celebrating, calling on everyone who's an artist to become a degenerate artist. In this system, that's the best thing to be, is degenerate when you're measuring it up against the system. All right, I'm really pleased to welcome back to the show after a considerable absence, but I'm sure he's going to say I was out on a frozen ice pack somewhere. His name is Josh Willis. He's an oceanographer and climatologist, and he's the principal investigator of Oceans Melting Greenland. And we'll talk about that in just a minute. A study was launched in 2015 by NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, and the study has released some dramatic and disturbing findings about the rate and mechanism of the melting and its contribution to destructive sea level rises. Josh Willis, welcome to the show.
Michael, so good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Okay, I'm going to hold you to that now, too.
All right.
Let's talk about this. I'm pulling out the March for Science, and I'm saying, which we'll talk about in a minute. But you just finished this. I understand you just finished a more recent round of OMG.
Right.
Now, I want you to tell people first, before we get started, what is OMG? And then we can talk about what you were doing in this new round.
Yeah, OMG is a mission we just started a couple years ago. And the goal is to figure out how much the oceans are eating away at the ice in Greenland, because we know Greenland's melting, the planet's warming, humans are causing this warming. But we think about Greenland usually as melting from the top down. The air gets warmer, it melts the surface, and it starts to disappear. But it turns out that a lot of the ice actually sits right in the water. And so the ocean can eat away at it from the edges. And that's what we're trying to measure with OMG.
Hmm. Tell me something. I'm kind of curious about this because I want to know how long that's sort of has that been going on, you know, because it's a little troubling. You're saying,
right. Well, the processes have all been there forever. I mean, the ice flows off of the land into the water, and it breaks off in big chunks that are called icebergs. We know what those are. This is part of the normal process, but what's happening is that the melting and the breaking off has exceeded the snowfall every year that happens in Greenland. So every year in the wintertime, it gets cold, it snows, Greenland builds up some extra mass, it gains some weight, just like me over the holidays. And then in the summer, it gets warm, it starts to melt, but that melting and the breaking off is now faster than the snow can add the mass back. So we're seeing Greenland thinning and disappearing, and over the course of 5 or so years, it loses about a trillion tons at a time.
Aha. Uh-huh. So you're going to market that, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Go, sit in this water.
Exactly.
But here's a question for you, though, because has this been a constant affair, or is it something that's just recently developed? And when you say Greenland is melting, is it possible that Greenland could disappear altogether?
Well, yeah. I mean, the warming that we've already had makes it pretty likely that Greenland is going to disappear. It's a question of, and when I say Greenland, I mean the ice in Greenland. And that's enough ice to raise sea levels by 20 feet, by the way. So it's a lot. The question is it going to be in 1,000 years, or is it going to be in 100 years, or somewhere in between? And the short answer is we just don't know. And a lot of what we're doing with OMG is trying to narrow that window down and figure out a little bit better just how fast the ice sheet can disappear.
And the thing, too, though, is that when you're talking about this, when you're talking about the rise in the ocean level, this is something that's planetary, not just like surrounding Greenland.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you know, 2/3 of our planet is covered with ocean, more than 2/3. And when Greenland melts, that water rises all around. So, you know, you live in Australia, well, you still care whether Greenland is melting, and because that water is going to be on your doorstep, too.
You know, I asked that question because I'm one of those people who probably would have been sitting there going, ah, it's Greenland, come on.
Yeah, right. I mean,
who's going to miss it? I mean, it is extremely serious when you think about this. And it's like, basically, that's the process that you're saying is in play right now, right?
That's right. And, you know, what we're seeing is a really rapid melting. If this much melting had been going on for like the last several thousand years, then sea level would already be a lot higher than it is. So we know this is something new. It's happening right now. And the rate at which it's happening is speeding up as we add more CO2 to the atmosphere, trap more heat, and drive our climate into a warmer place than it's been in tens or hundreds of thousands of years.
So now you're sitting here with the Trump regime who says, climate, schlimate. What do I care? You know, and also talks about, you know, I mean, even this thing about, which has always been a problem, including with what they set up in Paris and everything else, even with all the restrictions and all the falling short that they have in what came out of Paris, they're still to have that just be chopped away at and hacked away at the way it actually seems it's going to be under the Trump regime. You know, you're looking at this and you're thinking, damn, man, because this is something that's not, you know, it's not something to be played with. And you're looking at that and it's kind of like when you talk about, I was reading something you wrote recently, and I think it had to do with the current rise in ocean levels is from the early 1920s until now?
Yeah, I mean, that's when it's the fastest. So, uh-huh. You know, 100 years ago, sea level was going up at a rate of about 1 millimeter per year. 50 years ago, it was more like 2 millimeters per year. Now it's 3 millimeters per year and climbing. And, you know, once it gets up to 4 or 5 or even 10 millimeters per year, Now we're talking about sea level rise that's really going to be destructive really, really quickly. And, you know, these numbers sound small. I get it. You know, it's a few millimeters. You're standing on the beach watching these giant waves roll in. But you have to remember that every inch of sea level rise is like 8 feet of beach loss because the beach is slow.
Say that again.
So every foot of sea level rise is about 8 feet of beach loss on average.
Man. You know, and one of the things what I was trying to squeeze out of my head there is that when you're talking about this thing being that what you're concentrated on is the more recent stuff, but this has been happening generally over a whole historical period, right?
Well, the rise that we see today really began in either the late 1800s or the early 1900s mm-hmm. with the Industrial Revolution. We had about 2,000 years of stable sea level rise. So if you keep going back in time to 10 or 20,000 years ago, sea level was much lower because the world was colder. There was a big ice sheet. A lot of the water from the ocean was in that ice. What happened is about 10,000 years ago, that started to melt. Sea levels rose really rapidly, and then they stabilized. And we have good records for the last 2,000 years of a stable sea level. We can see back in time 2,000 years and we can see that sea levels were about like they were today or were at 1800 for the previous 2,000 years. And then in the last 100 years, 150 years, they're just shooting up like gangbusters. Mm-hmm. So this is a new thing and it's really tied to the Industrial Revolution. It's really tied to human-caused climate change.
That's what I wanted to hear more of in terms of it being tied to the Industrial Revolution and human-caused climate change. This is an extremely important thing for people to understand.
Yeah, the rise that we see today is pretty much all human-caused. There's not really a background rate of rise that's significant at all. If it was, we would be able to see it in all these other records, but it's not. It's been stable for 2,000 years, and then it's shooting up right here at the end. And the other thing is that you got to remember the oceans absorb 90% of the heat that's trapped by the greenhouse gases. So they're really the main repository for storing the extra heat. That means when the oceans warm up, they expand. That causes sea level rise. And then, of course, the glaciers and melting ice sheets cause sea level rise too. So when you look at the rising oceans, it's kind of the most powerful indicator. This is two-thirds of the planet we're talking about changing its shape, growing by an inch a decade or so right now. And it's a huge signal. It's the most obvious signal we have of human-caused climate change.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and today we're talking with Josh Willis, who's from OMG. Actually, you're from, what's that place out in Pasadena?
The Jet Propulsion Laboratory.
Right, exactly. There you go. The Jet Propulsion. And that, now look, I want people to be sure that they don't think that you're out there on like a ski board or something, some skiing thing, and you're just zipping through whatever they call them. I'm doing really good today.
I turned in my rocket boots a long
rocket
time ago.
Boots, there you go. Dave. But you know, when you're talking about this, I keep thinking, okay, if this is human caused, is it human solvable? Is it actually solvable, a way to resolve this in a good way in the period of time we have in front of us?
Yeah, I mean, look, Michael, we're going to get some more warming kind of no matter what we do. But the question is, do we want to get hit in the head with a ping pong ball or a bowling ball? And that choice is up to us. So we can make a difference. We can avoid the biggest amounts of warming, the most destruction. But, you know, we have to prepare for a little bit different climate no matter what we do, too.
Mm-hmm. And there's something you wrote in a piece that you said, every decade brings a new climate onto the planet. How does that work?
Well, we're warming the planet every decade by an amount that sets new records. I mean, you know, every couple of years you hear, well, we set a new global temperature record. Well, we set another new global temperature record. We set another new global temperature record. And pretty much every year we warm the climate by an amount that really makes it distinct and different than anything we've seen in 100,000 years or more. So we're entering a new climate regime pretty much every 10 years.
Which I'm assuming will not be reversed during the lifetime of people who are living today and maybe their grandkids and other, and they're going down the line for quite some time.
Yeah, it's really hard to reverse what's already happened. We add CO2 to the atmosphere. We add heat to the ocean. These are things that happen across. And taking the carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere permanently is really, really hard to do. We can do it on a small scale. But doing it on a scale big enough to matter for the whole planet, we just haven't figured out how to do that yet. So the chances are we're stuck with what we've already done.
You were getting ready to say the chances are we're screwed. that's pretty much what. No, but the point is actually because this is a very critical question for people to understand and to do what they can now, because to throw our hands up and just allow the planet to be destroyed and everything in it, it's not just, you know, it's every species, everything in it is just like it's going to be deeply impacted, if not wiped out. And humanity will certainly be wiped out. And to me, there is a question of doing as much as we can to try and, one, understand what's happening and reverse it to the extent that we can, but try to figure out how to actually deal with this in a way that wouldn't mean the end of the planet.
Yeah, I mean, humans are now the primary drivers of climate change, of the changing climate. In fact, geologists have labeled this a new era, the Anthropocene, meaning the era when humans are affecting the climate. So that means we have a big choice to make, and we have a big responsibility. You know, we're making changes that are going to be there forever as far as we're concerned, and we need to be responsible about it, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. Now, tell me this. Part of what you've been doing, I mean, OMG is, and it's funny, you named it precisely because of that name.
right.
OMG!
OMG!
Right. But there's this other point about what that actually means and the fact that we're looking at this, and I'm trying to think about, like, there's been stuff that you've done, like this Jason project that I was really intrigued by, and you are the luckiest guy I know, man. You get to go run around and do things called Jason, and you're doing this, and you're out there, and it's very cool. But you're also really working to carry this stuff out, and this Jason project or whatever it is, I'm saying because I can't remember the full name of it, but the Jason project is really a critical aspect of understanding what's happening. And on that basis, if we understand what's happening, is there a chance to reverse this?
Yeah. So the Jason missions are a series of satellites that just measure sea level. They measure how tall the ocean is, and that tells us things about the oceans, like where the currents are going, when El Niño is happening. But it also tells us about sea level rise. So it's this indicator of our human-caused climate change footprint on the climate. And it's really important because as we look into the future, we're looking at more sea level rise, but our ability to predict how much is not so good. Right now, if you ask most experts how much sea level rise are we going to get by the end of the century, they'll say, well, somewhere between 1 foot and 7 feet. All right. That's a pretty big range. Right. And, you know, it's just because we don't really understand how the Earth is going to react to all this extra heat. And so what we're doing with things like the Jason mission and things like OMG is trying to better figure out just how big our footprint can be. And also, how much are we committed to a certain amount of sea level rise or a certain amount of warming? You know, there's this idea of climate commitment. You put so much CO2 in the atmosphere, the Earth is going to react. And how big is that reaction going to be? You know, it's kind of like asking the question, if we turned off the knob for putting CO2 in the atmosphere, how much change would we get anyway, no matter what we did? So those are things that are important for helping us make decisions about how much of an impact we want to make. But right now, we don't seem to be capable, in my opinion, of making the tough decision and deciding to turn the ship toward a more stable climate and a sustainable economy.
Do you think that's a broadly popular problem, or do you think that's actually something in terms of the kind of policy that's come out?
Well, it's the policy. I mean, I think people really are starting to get climate change. I mean, we can tell it's happening. How many giant Rhode Island size ice shelves have to break up before we say, okay, something's happening to our planet? The hard part is deciding what to do about it. And, you know, we have to do that together, and we have to do it through policy. I mean, yes, you know, you should try and reduce your carbon footprint. You should try and avoid dirty energy. Vote with your dollar. But at the end of the day, we have to have help from our leaders. And right now, in my opinion, we're not getting it.
Yeah, you think.
Right.
I mean, let's just be frank. Trump gets out there and he says, he basically, in his budget that he put out there, he says, climate, yeah, you're going to do something about it? No, we're not interested.
Yeah.
You know, and that sort of portends, it basically points to a very bad direction for all of humanity.
I mean, it's frustrating to me to be having the conversation of whether or not it's happening again. We need to be talking about what we're going to do about it instead of if it exists. Mm. So I feel like certainly in the public conversation, we're kind of taking a step backwards here.
Mm-hmm. Now, tell me something real quick, because we have our next guest waiting on the line. But if you were to step back and say, okay, look, this is the most significant thing that has to be done. And if we do that, we can actually, this is what's going to set us on the path to where we need to go. And you could include, you know, getting rid of the fascist Trump. But there's also – there's more that actually needs – there's a process that needs to be
done. I mean, to me, we have to set an energy policy that rewards energy sources that don't warm up the planet and penalizes energy sources that do. We have to steer the economy and we have to steer people's choices towards more sustainable ones. Otherwise, you know, we can't leave that decision unmade because otherwise it's just going to be driven by profits. And that's not necessarily the logical or reasonable choice.
Yeah. And that's why I believe we need a whole new system that doesn't run by profit. That's exactly what we need, you know, because, you know, really, when we were talking last time about the El Nino and the impact of something like that and how that's related to climate change. And we ended up talking about what was going on in Greenland at that point.
Yeah.
You know, because that's how interwoven these things are. We are going to have to move on. But you're welcome to stay around, actually, if you want to hang out and listen to this. And it's, you know, that'd be good. And throw in, you know, because you're out there and you're doing all this stuff.
Thank you.
So, yeah. So I definitely want to thank you for being in today, man. I think it's very important what you're doing. And we need to stay in touch. You're going to have to become our regular climate guy.
Okay? I would love that. Thank you, Michael.
All right, Josh Willis, thank you very much for joining us today. We're going to take a quick musical break and we'll be right back. Talking with Brant Olson, Executive Director of ClimateTruth.org, and he's one of the people who's been assisting in organizing the March for Science coming up, so stay tuned. Welcome back. That was Thievery Corporation with Babylon Falling. Yes, Babylon Falling. And it's melting as well. So listen, we're going to be joining Brant Olson in just a second, but I sort of lassoed Josh Willis to stay behind and just tell me, so, Mr. Willis, are you going to be at the march this month?
Yes, month? Michael, I am going to march. I'm going to exercise my right to speak up in favor of science. You know, I think we're at a moment when science needs a voice to say, hey, this is important, not even because of the political spectrum, but science is important to our everyday lives. It's one of the ways we figure out what's true. Mm-hmm. And I think that's an important message.
All right, Josh, thanks a lot, man. And now you can run out the door and I'll talk to you later, man. I'm going to take that tour, the whole JPL thing that's going to be.
I'm looking forward to it,
all
Michael.
Right,
thanks so
all
much.
Right, take care now. All right, now I'm really pleased to welcome to the show Brant Olson. Brant, how are you?
I'm doing good. Thanks very much.
Good, good, good. And I should tell people that you are the executive director of ClimateTruth.org, a group that helped organize the Stand Up for Science rally, and is assisting in the March for Science. We're going to talk today about the March for Science on April 22nd in Washington, D.C., and as well as other parts of the country, satellite marches in over 430 other cities. That's correct?
Yeah, hundreds all over the world.
That's great, man. That's really great. Now, tell me this. The March for Science, just for people who might not know, what is it and what gave rise to it?
Well, you know, it's one of those things that could only happen with the internet. Shortly after the Trump administration started sending out letters asking for the names of folks within government that were working on climate change, scientists got understandably worried and started taking action. And this started as an idea on Reddit, an online kind of community, and grew like crazy and almost overnight. So at this point, you know, there's more than 1 million people that are following along on Facebook and Twitter and elsewhere. And as you just mentioned, you know, more than 400 marches organized all over the world. So pretty clear response from the science community saying that they're not going to be pushed around.
Yeah, that was kind of an out of the lab and into the streets response that developed among scientists. And that was really phenomenal, I think.
Yeah, I mean, it, as I say, only with the internet. More than 1 million people mobilized virtually overnight. This is really just an organic response, I think, to some real threats to science that are being posed by Trump and his friends in Congress.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you're talking about the March for Science, people are going to want to know, well, what exactly? Can you tell us something specifically? What is the specific program that it might stand for? And it doesn't have to be, you know, step by step, but what's the overall program that the March for Science is advocating?
Well, I think it's really advocating to resist the legal wrecking ball that the Trump administration has taken to science and the planet. Some things that have already been done in terms of cabinet appointments with Scott Pruitt as head of the EPA, with an oil company executive appointed to the State Department. I mean, this is really about an evisceration of all of the various supports that exist within our government for basic things like research into disease, into climate change. And so the march is about people standing up against that and in favor of science-based policymaking. So that's why we're coming out into the street.
Mm-hmm. Now, there's something I read recently that made that point in this way, which said, while the march is explicitly nonpartisan, it is political. And that was said by one of the organizers of the march. And I wanted to actually see if you could explain that for people.
Sure. Well, I mean, this isn't not a Republican issue. It's not a Democrat issue by any means. We've got folks that are going to be turning out and folks that are organizing from across the political spectrum. But what this is about is making sure that science continues to be the foundation on which we build our policy. So institutions such as NOAA and NASA and the National Institutes of Health, these are all services of our government that study, you know, the natural world, that study biology, that study the causes and consequences of disease and keep us healthy. And when you start defunding those institutions, you start eroding that foundation on which good policy is made. And ultimately, that means that our communities are going to suffer. It means that we can't defend ourselves from disease outbreak. We can't defend ourselves from the ravages of climate change.
Mm-hmm. I want to remind listeners that this is the Michael Slate Show, and I'm speaking with Brant Olson, Executive Director of ClimateTruth.org, a group that helped organize the Stand Up for Science rally, and we're talking about the March for Science, which Brant is helping to organize. And it really is true, that point about a government that ignores all this, that ignores science in general, but especially in relation to all this, it endangers the world overall and everything in it and everyone in it. That's a fairly important thing for people to keep in mind.
Right. And scientists, I think, and I've talked with hundreds over the course of our work on this, don't tend to view themselves as especially political. You know, they want to be in their laboratories. They want to be doing their work. And they don't necessarily want to be, you know, shouting in the megaphone or protesting on the street. But it's come to such a threat level that that's necessary. Just doing the science isn't enough at this point. It's really up to scientists and those that support science, believe in science, to mobilize, because it's under real substantial threat, really an unprecedented threat in terms of the history of the United States.
Mm-hmm. You know, when you say that about an unprecedented threat, are there things you could expand on in that along that vein? I mean, something you would be able to say to people, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, so the government agencies that I just mentioned, let's take, for example, the EPA. The Environmental Protection Agency, Trump has proposed cutting the budget by a third, laying off thousands of people from the department. Scott Pruitt, the head of the EPA, made a career out of bringing litigation to stop enforcement of basic programs that protect our communities. So those are the types of threats that we're pushing back against. We need a strong EPA in order to preserve species, in order to be sure that we have healthy, clean water to drink, that we have clean air to breathe. And by, you know, cutting the agency back, which I should say is already, you know, doesn't have the funds that needs to fulfill its purpose, you know, we're really dealing a blow back to our communities. That's the point, that science isn't just for science sake. Science isn't about just sort of testing things because you're curious, although that's a big part of it. It's about protecting our communities, and that's what Trump and company are really going after.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, it's interesting. Carolyn Weinberg, who is one of the people who was involved in this from the very beginning, she made the statement that the point of science is getting to the truth and helping us understand the world. And acting as though this has no role in politics is absolutely ridiculous. That was a fairly important statement for somebody to make in this period. And true.
Yeah, it's absolutely true. And I think, obviously, there's a lot of different opinion and debate across on this across the science community. But I think a positive sign that we've seen is a lot of the biggest scientific organizations sort of taking a step and stepping up and becoming more vocal on these issues. So folks like the Academy of Sciences here in the U.S. and the American Geophysical Union, geologists, right, the largest geophysical science organization in the country, are now, you know, asking their members and their supporters to mobilize and support these marches. So I think, you know, the science community as a whole is beginning to recognize that science is political. And in order to preserve science, we need to get active politically. We need to hold our elected officials accountable.
And actually, some of this is important in terms of how this is spread. I mean, it's been very interesting. It's one thing to have it happen here, and it's very encouraging and very good and very important that people are standing up against this Nazi that's in the White House. At the same time, this has become very much an international thing as well. That's been a pretty significant development, right?
Yeah. And I think, you know, the world has looked to the United States for a long time to kind of set the bar in terms of what solid science looks like. And the government has been an important source of support for science ongoing, you know, here in the United States and abroad. And so when you have Rex Tillerson, you know, the former CEO of ExxonMobil, representing the United States interests abroad, his interests certainly, you know, do not relate to science. I mean, if you look at the history of ExxonMobil, they knew as early as the late 70s about the basic science behind climate change. And instead of changing their business model to respond to the threats posed by climate change and caused by the emissions of fossil fuels, ExxonMobil doubled down and, you know, essentially funded a multi-decade effort to undermine science. So that doesn't give, you know, a lot of confidence to those who are interested in spreading science throughout the world that's going to happen moving forward, because the folks who are in charge have made a career out of undermining the basic science behind climate change in the case of Rex Tillerson.
Mm-hmm. And when you add into that the whole question of the U.S. military and its role in terms of its impact, its negative impact on the climate through the use of oil, the biggest user of oil in the entire universe, you know, and that's not changing anytime soon. Brandt, I want to thank you very much for joining us today. Is there anything else you'd like to add before we go?
Well, just to pitch the how to get involved. So visit marchforscience.com to get sort of the whole global picture. Thanks for having me on.
Sure. And we'll stay in touch, okay?
Okay.
All right. Take care, man. Bye now. And for information on the March for Science, it's Earth Day, April 22nd. Go to marchforscience.com as well. You can also find satellite marches. There are 32 marches in California alone, sisters and brothers. Now, there's a number of important demonstrations that have been scheduled beginning the second part of April, going right up against some of the most hateful policies of the Trump-Pence regime. These demonstrations include the April 22nd March for Science, the April 29th People's Climate March, and the May 1st protests against the attacks on immigrants. In a statement released on April 2nd, Refuse Fascism endorsed these demonstrations and called for mass contingents of many thousands of people under the banner of No, in the name of humanity, we refuse to accept the fascist America. Drive out the Trump-Pence regime. And again, you can go to the site revcom.us, and you'll see this right on the front page of the site, or go to Revolution Newspaper inside the site, and you can read all about the campaign, Drive Out the Trump-Pence Regime, and find out how you can become part of it. So once again, those websites are refusefascism.org and revcom.us for news, to find out how to get involved, and much, much more. Now, there's something I wanted to read. There's an important article on revcom.us. Once again, it's revcom.us, and it's called No Time for Celebration. The Trump-Pence juggernaut remains on a roll and must be driven out. You can find the link on my Facebook page. The article begins this way. The past 2 weeks have spun by at a dizzying pace. Trump's new anti-Muslim ban was instituted and quickly blocked by federal district court judges. The hearings on possible ties between the Trump camp and Russia leading into the elections opened. And then on Friday, the Republican health care bill was defeated. All of these were actual setbacks for the regime. But to put it bluntly, this raft of difficulties and setbacks does not necessarily signify that the regime has suffered or will soon suffer mortal blows. In fact, as the article goes on to show, they are still moving very quickly to hammer a fascist form of rule into place. And I really recommend that people check out the full article at revcom.us, No Time for Celebration, and check out the important events coming up in April and May, when hundreds of thousands or more will be in the streets. That just about does it for the show this week. I want to thank all of my guests. I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, and my board op for today, Kiana Williams. And she's my board op for all the time, for eternity, all right? And we'll talk to you again next week.